If you look in your wallet, the stuff we're talking about this weekend is where that money goes. Gas, alcohol, football. This is Super Bowl weekend, after all. Not perhaps the most highbrow of shopping lists, but one that touches your everyday existence, or at least a lot of our weekend existences. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we've also got stories about looking forward, finding optimism in this economy, figuring out how to navigate low oil prices, and doing the math on public pension funds to see whether promised retirement money is really going to be there. Come share your feedback with us at marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. I mentioned looking forward. The first primary of this very long election year is coming up this Tuesday, and so far we've heard a lot of you expressing economic anxiety. You're doing better, but maybe it doesn't feel permanent. So in the middle of this, we wanted to know what you're actually optimistic about when it comes to the economy. We're starting with John Brooks. He owns a small boat building business in Brooklyn, Maine. And yes, since the recession, fewer people can afford to buy his boats, but they are coming to his boat building classes.
So increasingly what we're finding is that what people really want is they want experiences. They want to learn stuff. I teach for the Wooden Boat School, and it is associated with Wooden Boat Magazine. It's basically it's a camp for adults. They come, they can learn, you know, spend a week learning how to build a particular type of boat or a particular method of construction. But they also really enjoy the camaraderie of other people that love boats. They may, you know, go back to New York or Boston or wherever and never talk about boats for a whole year. But when they come here, they can spend the whole week talking about boats. So
Well, let me ask you. You noted the recession, you have this small business, and, you know, as you said, when times get tough, one of the first things people cut is discretionary spending. So I guess, how do you find that kernel of optimism? Where'd you find that?
I guess you just keep looking in all the nooks and crannies. Again, I'm fortunate to be working very part-time for Wooden Boat School. But seeing the smiles on people's faces when they learn stuff and what they enjoy doing, and how they will spend, you know, what little money they can spend on discretionary stuff, where they'll spend it. I'm old enough that I did grow up, my grandfather teaching me how to use tools and stuff like that. I can share that gift with other people, and the process of discovery is really cool. It's just like, wow, that worked. You know, when you figure something out, you know, you've been frustrated for hours and hours or days and days, and then finally something breaks through, you go, wow, that's really cool. And so I'm able to, you know, with the woodworking and the boat building, I can share that.
John Brooks, thank you for talking with me.
You're very welcome. Thank you. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Like John, Mary Jane Lowe is also in Maine. Hey, thanks for listening, Maine. She's inspired by the people in her community who are becoming entrepreneurs.
I'm really encouraged to see the little businesses and all the little grassroots and the way people are adapting and creating. And I've noticed some really small oil and propane delivery companies popping up, which I thought was great because some of the ones that we've had are being taken over by larger conglomerates. And it seems like the response has been for local folks to start up their own. It's interesting. I was thinking about how different it is that it's a very sort of rugged, individualistic kind of society and group, and yet there's also this strong sense of community. And that really gives me hope when things are a little shaky on a larger scale.
You're retired, and I would imagine that you watch your retirement accounts very closely. How do you feel about the financial system and situation right now?
Well, I have, of course, been quite nervous as I've been watching the ups and downs. I really am having faith that we'll have sanity prevail in Congress as things shift. That's my hope, that there won't be any more debt ceiling and other kind of foolishnesses that, you know, reduce our credit rating, which I get very nervous because I live on Social Security plus what I've, you know, sort of stashed away in investments. And so I'm a cautious optimist. I guess I feel cautiously optimistic. I feel good about our country in terms of our own person. You know, our country's our national economic system. But I'm a little concerned about some of the hot spots around the world and what that could do to really upset everything.
Mary Jane Lowe, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Looking at the bigger economic picture now, Shane Algarin in San Diego wrote us on Facebook. He's optimistic that technology is going to change the way voters connect to the people representing them.
I just think it's doing wonders in the private sector, and the potential it has to do the same miraculous things in the public sector and in government and in politics is there's no limits to it. You know, the cynic in me wants to believe that politics is corrupt, but the optimist in me says there's just a breakdown in communication. There's no two-way communication. And if they had a better gauge on what their district wants before they vote on a piece of legislation, if voters could vote on that legislation, they could have a clear idea of how they should really vote on a piece of legislation. And I think technology is going to bridge that lack of communication.
Well, what economic issues do you think about? And do they make you optimistic?
They do if we place the right policies. I am a little concerned about technology replacing jobs, but we've known this is going to happen for decades. And I think automation and technology is nothing to fear as long as we have the right labor laws in place. You know, as unemployment creeps up, maybe we send the market a signal that, you know, humans don't need to be working so much. 5 days a week is not necessary. Maybe 4 or 3 days a week.
You sound like you spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff.
I do. Technology, it really fascinates me, and that's why today I own an electronics business, and every day I just want to become more tech savvy and soak it all up.
Shane Algarin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
For next week, President Obama is releasing his budget proposal, and that got us wondering, what are your budget priorities? What eats up the lion's share? What do you focus on, and how are you going to do it? Let us know by visiting our website, marketplace.org, chatting with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Each week, we ask celebrities to open up, take us behind the curtain, and tell us about how money moves through their lives. Well, it's kind of more like we ask them to ask themselves. But anyway, our guest this week?
I'm Susan Orlean. I'm a writer and author of 7 books. Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you... all of the accoutrements of happiness. It can buy you time. It will allow you the opportunity for happiness. Question number 2. In a next life, what would your career be? What I really would like to be is a backup singer so that I get all the pleasure of being on stage and singing, but none of the pressure of having to be the front man. What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows? Performance anxiety. The feeling that as a writer, what you're really doing is essentially a performance, even though it's on the page. You're exposing yourself and presenting yourself to the world, and you become fair game for either being ignored or rejected or criticized, and that part of it is really tough. It's emotionally very challenging, and no matter how many times you go through it, it's still a very difficult thing and hard. The fact is that if you're doing this kind of work, you want it to be liked, and you want it to be read, and you want it to be accepted. So it's a bit specious to say you're doing it for yourself, because then you could write a little journal and stick it under your pillow. So if you're publishing, you are asking for the approval of the unknown out there who are reading your work, and it's a really hard part of it. when did you realize writing could be a career? I'm still waiting for that moment. But, you know, it's all I've ever done as a profession. Right out of college, I waited tables briefly, as I feel everyone should. Little experience in the service industry. And then I started writing. And luckily, I was living somewhere very inexpensive. I was earning very little money, but it was enough to support myself. What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying? Oh my God, how many hours do you have for this answer? Oh my God, let me give you a little background. I am an early adopter, so any curious, interesting gadget or gizmo I want. And there is a trail of tears that marks many, many purchases of things that were exciting and interesting and seductive, very beta, very not ready for consumers to really be enjoying. And I was there in the front line buying it. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career? Number one, take your time. That the arc of a career is long, and it doesn't all have to feel that it's happening instantly. And in that case, enjoy it, absorb it, find your way, and don't push so hard. Be ambitious, but be aware that there's a timeline that it extends beyond the horizon. And that's really hard when you're young. And it may have been advice that, had I been given it, I would have ignored anyway.
That's author and writer Susan Orlean. Next week, actor and comedian Paul Reiser takes the Marketplace quiz. Come join us. The stories on our shows are often dominated by numbers, which is kind of the nature of money. And here at Marketplace, our By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them every day on marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with some of this week's news by the numbers. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is...
$1 billion.
It's how many dollars it could cost to get a Zika vaccine to market, according to one estimate.
The first cases were identified in the U.S. this week, and the World Health Organization estimates there will be millions of cases worldwide this year.
Pregnant women and children are especially at risk, which makes developing a treatment more complicated.
$13 million.
That's how many Americans have a secret bank or credit account hidden from their partner.
That's according to a new report from creditcards.com.
Part of the reason? Millennials grew up in a time when divorce became more and more common. They're also waiting longer to get married, which can make them more cautious about eventually sharing their finances.
Two.
Does Ted Cruz wear two watches?
I don't know. It certainly looks like it. Photos of him at campaign events show him with a wristband on each arm, at least.
The time has come to stop losing sleep over this. The Atlantic did an exhaustive examination, and it turns out one of them is actually just a Fitbit.
Thank God someone cleared that up.
If you follow finance at all, you know the terms long and short. Long for betting on something, like a stock, short for betting against it. We do that here with news stories, topics and trends we are positive and negative about. This week, to play the long and short game, we've got Marketplace's own DC Bureau Chief, Dave Shaw, and Danielle Belton, an associate editor at The Root. Welcome back to you both.
Ah, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
All right, Danielle, you are batting first today. Give me your long.
My long is Mattel's new line of Barbies. They have four different sizes, curvy, petite, tall, and original. They come in seven different skin tones, 12 eye colors, 24 hairstyles. And I'm really, really excited about them because Barbie's an icon. And the fact that they're willing to change the doll in so many different ways to try to appeal to the broadest base possible really means a lot to me, especially as a person of color, being African-American. And I loved Barbie as a kid. I collected Barbies. I had a Barbie coloring book. And I used to originally, because Barbie was always white, I used to color all my Barbies white. Until my dad sat down with me one day and colored with me, and he colored his Barbie brown and said, look how beautiful she is. And so my dad became just obsessed with finding black Barbies for me. So anything that makes it easier for a little girl to get a Barbie that looks like her so she can see a representation of herself and play with that, it, you know, means a lot to me. So I really think this is exciting.
And these Barbies have, shall we say, slightly more realistic measurements.
Yes, proportions. Yes. It's nice to see a curvy Barbie, a Barbie that shops at Lane Bryant.
All right, Dave, we're going to pivot big time because you do not have a toy or even an icon of what American womanhood for your long. What do you got for us?
I'm going long on voting. I'm going long on campaigning. I'm going long on superdelegates, dare I say it. We got our first voting this week.
Wow, Washington and bureau chief.
Go figure. You did ask me to be politicky before we came
on.
So here we are. We have a tight field, and we're going to see it. You know, it's beginning to shake out, but I think we've got a long ways to go before we're going to know who the nominees are for president. And as the Washington bureau chief, I'm excited.
Remind us why a superdelegate is so important.
Okay, so as the candidates roll through the primaries, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, Alabama, Arkansas, so on and so forth, they're picking up delegates. And the delegates, they would go to the conventions in the summertime, and you need a certain threshold of delegates in order to win the nomination. Superdelegates are these sort of free agent players who can vote for whomever they want at the convention. And so the number of superdelegates that you have committed to your campaign can help you overcome if maybe somebody doesn't have enough, or if it's really close.
Danielle, your short is on the campaign theme, so I'm going to let you just kind of slide right in there.
Okay. Well, my short is on Republican candidates who keep talking about physically beating and or spanking Hillary Clinton. Like, it's the grossest thing ever. It's intellectually lazy, and it's really sexist sounding. Chris Christie recently said he would beat her rear end on that stage, and afterwards she'd be relieved that I didn't serve her with a subpoena. And, you know, Ted Cruz gave, like, this lengthy spanking metaphor about how when his daughter acts up, he gives her a spanking, and, you know, the voters should give Hillary Clinton a spanking. And Jeb Bush said he'd whoop her. You know,
do we know if this appeals to voters at all?
It can't possibly. When Jeb Bush said it, like, he actually got some boos. Like, people were just confused by it. I mean, I get it. You know, they all want to sound like they're tough on Hillary Clinton. But, I mean, I just don't know what's up with this weirdly gender-coded, trivializing, like, violent language. I mean,
There are real issues to discuss in a campaign, and, like, go for it, everybody. Yeah.
Yeah.
If the rhetoric is here now, imagine where we're going to be in the fall.
Well, I'm thinking about campaigning. I think I might be short money, or maybe short rate of return.
Some of the candidates are.
Yeah, well, this is I'm bringing up the Jeb Bush money thing because people were crunching the numbers, coming up with spending, what, $5,200 per vote. And granted, that's all the spending they've done, and we've only had one voting occasion, the Iowa caucuses, so far, and we're coming up on another one very quickly. But boy, that's not a great bargain.
That's not much of a return on investment.
Dave, what are you short?
I am short on renting. And the reason I am is because rents are going up. We know that. If you rent, you know that. But there was an analysis that was out this week from Zillow, you know, the home data company, that said that the time it takes you to break even on your costs if you switch from renting to buying is falling. It's less than 2 years in most metro areas now. So, you know, between the home price is beginning to rise a little more rapidly, and interest rates also beginning to rise, I wonder if we're going to see more renters deciding to make the move and go into housing.
That this is maybe the moment where the pendulum starts to swing back the other way towards buying?
You always see that, right? It really is the pendulum where one makes financial sense and then it gets a little bit ridiculous, as is the case with rents in a lot of metro areas now. Washington, D.C. is one, and I know New York is another. So I think we may see a switch more toward home buying from renting.
I know it's funny because in Washington, D.C., the rent is so high, plus the houses are so expensive. I mean, what's the next move? Cardboard box?
Danielle Belton from The Root, Dave Shaw, our Washington bureau chief here at Marketplace. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
If you've been paying attention to the news lately or filled up your car with cheap gas, this may sound familiar.
It is the one commodity that affects everyone, and the price is still extremely low.
Oil is certainly front and center here. Now, why did oil fall 6%?
Part of the reason we're seeing this dramatic fall in stocks, oil prices. Oil prices also falling, hitting 12-year lows.
Cheap oil, cheap gas, good for the economy, bad for the economy? Which is it?
Well, in Gillette, Wyoming, it's pretty clear low oil prices are bad news. Oil is one of the main drivers of the area's economy, and we check in every so often with mayors around the country, including Louise Carter King, who is the mayor of Gillette. When we spoke a couple of months ago, she was worried about low oil, so we got her back on the line to see how things are going now.
Our economy here is kind of split between oil and coal, so both, you know, have been hit. And as booms and busts go, this one's kind of a double whammy on us right now. Actually, coal is probably the more stable of the two at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, we had heard is that the general fund revenues in Wyoming are expected to be, you know, $5 million less than was projected just a couple of months ago. So how do you, as a mayor, plan when you're trying to kind of stay on top of all this?
Well, I have good staff, that's for sure. We have been, you know, the coal market has been soft for quite a while. So as far as our sales tax and all, we've been preparing for that, because when coal goes down, then so do the big purchases of the trucks and shovels and all that equipment that's very expensive. So that hurts our sales tax here, which we rely on quite a bit. And then, of course, the property tax going down also with less mining. And that's where the oil, you know, and coal really, really hits us. But we had a retreat this weekend, and we just discussed ways that we can just tighten our belt and delay a few projects. But we're still going strong. We're still good.
What kind of belts do you have to tighten?
Well, like I say, we're going to delay some projects and not do some projects this budget year that we had, you know, had planned on. And we may look at some services that we can, you know, curb a little bit. But for right now, we've budgeted for this downfall or downturn. And so, you know, right now we're doing okay.
One of the things I'm curious about is, you know, when you have an energy area or an energy town, often you have a lot of kind of supportive stuff that goes along with that. Housing, restaurants, all of those things. What are you seeing in those businesses?
Well, nothing's closed or anything so far. Some people think we were underserved anyway in the restaurant business, but I'm sure those businesses probably don't look at it quite like that. No one likes to lose business. But what we decided to do at our retreat is to continue to do some of our maintenance type work, like on our streets and infrastructure, because that puts money out on the street, so to speak, for the local contractors and all. Because if the government stops spending, you know, on services, then that starts hurting the private industries.
Are there things that would help, you know, nationally on a policy level for you guys, or even internationally if you're watching OPEC or anything like that?
Well, of course, we would like to see oil go up. That would help this area, plus many areas across the nation. Of course, everyone now is enjoying cheap gas, which I understand. You know, everyone likes to, you know, fill up for 20, 30 bucks compared to 50 or 70. But that's taking a lot of those jobs that the oil industry provides are very high paying jobs. So when you lose those, you're losing those people buying new vehicles and building or buying houses. So that does affect the economy, you know, much more than, you know, say a meatpacking plant closing or something like that.
What do your constituents come in and tell you?
Well, they're nervous, too. We haven't had any widespread layoffs or anything, but everyone is nervous that you just don't know the timing of this oil. Everyone says to a person that it will come back, and it always has. And this area is used to the booms and busts. I myself have a small business, and my business has been going since 1978. So, you know, we've been through them before, but they're never fun. And this one is, like I say, a little, you know, kind of a double whammy. I always say if you can survive through the bust, you can survive anything.
Louise Carter King, mayor of Gillette, Wyoming. As always, it's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Lizzie. I appreciate talking to you.
Each week, you tell us about a story that's happening where you live, and we dig a little deeper. Today's suggestion comes from listener Rob Wellington. He wanted to know about the state pension fund in Colorado. It's called the Public Employee Retirement Association, also known as PERA. Like a lot of pension funds around the country, it's not in the greatest shape. It's currently short about $26 billion in what it owes to more than 500,000 members across the state. To learn more, we called up Peter Marcus, the Denver Bureau reporter for the Durango Herald. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Who is depending on this retirement fund?
So what you have is you have all of the state employees across the state are dependent on PERA. And right around the time of the economic downturn in 2008, it started to become apparent that this program was facing serious unfunded liabilities, liabilities that stand today at $26 billion.
When you talk about unfunded liabilities, you basically mean the system isn't taking in enough money to pay out what its retirees are expecting, correct?
Correct, exactly. What happened is the markets, the market forces, you know, there was the economic downturn. It took a huge turn. And the state legislature in 2010 had to get together. And what they realized was that it was going to take a sacrifice on the part of both employers and employees to really make sure that the system is stable so that they can enjoy the benefits in years to come.
Well, how does that work out? I mean, does that mean if you're a retiree or going to be one, you're expecting to get less? Or if you're a business that you're putting in more? How does it work?
So the employees would have had to kick in 2% more, employers also having to kick in that 2%, and then employees also had to take a hit on their cost of living adjustment, which I believe was somewhere around 1.5%. When the state legislature in 2010 set about its reform efforts, it also called for a study 5 years later to report back on how things are doing. And what they found is that that shared sacrifice is paying off, but that we're still a good 38 years away from this system being fully funded.
So if you look 38 years down the road, what does that mean?
If you look 38 years down the road, assuming that this sacrifice continues to play its role, then you're looking at getting rid of those unfunded liabilities and not having a problem for future retirees.
When you talk to people in Colorado who are depending on this money, you know, school teachers, state troopers, employees of different municipalities, what do they tell you?
This is a subject that gets people riled up. You're talking
yeah.
about your retirement savings. You're talking about your future, your golden years. And so what people are saying is that they acknowledged that the markets took a turn, the economy sunk, and that they had to kick in. But now it's like this better work. And it's difficult to get the legislature to get together on such a significant subject. So really what where we're at is hoping that these reforms continue to work. And that the folks who I talk to are saying they're the ones who are hoping that this really works because they're the ones who are dependent on it.
For people who are retirees and have seen their benefits cut a little bit, how has that impacted their lives?
It has not been a significant impact to their lives in the sense that back to the shared sacrifice concept, it was something that they could live with, which is why I say that the hope is that it better work because if you start going back and talking about more sacrifice, that's when I think that people are really going to get riled up.
We're talking about Colorado here, but there are a lot of systems like this across the country. Are PERA's investments unusual or are they the kind of normal stuff that a big pension system invests in?
Not unusual at all. In fact, this is, you know, pretty common. When they launched this shared, quote, shared sacrifice effort, what they did was the board traveled the state. They went around the state. They listened to members. They listened to the concerns. They listened to what was realistic to ask for as part of this shared sacrifice. And what they said is other pension funds, state pension funds across the nation started to take notice. And Colorado sort of became a model to other states on how to go about engaging members, starting that conversation, and working towards a more sustainable future.
Peter Marcus, Denver reporter for the Durango Herald, thank you very much.
You are very welcome.
Come tell us about the most important economic story where you live. Go to marketplace.org and click on Local Money. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and on my 21st birthday, I engaged in the time-honored American tradition of making bad decisions, specifically trying to do a lot of shots in a college bar. Sound familiar from your own youth? My weapon of choice is the subject of this story by Marketplace's Mark Garrison, a story about branding and taking a liquor known for bad college decisions like mine and trying to make it fancy.
The Up and Up is a New York bar that makes complicated and expensive cocktails. It's the type of place where people talk about their drinks like this.
In the nose, we got dense herbal aromas. Definitely predominantly is anise. We got some orange in the background.
That's Niels Böse, who runs a bar in Germany. He's drinking a European liqueur, and by the way, he's still talking about it.
Herbal notes, some clove, some cinnamon.
The drink he is going on and on about is Jägermeister. Yes, Jägermeister, the fuel that powered the ship that carried 1,000 drunken bros. It is not something most people expect to find in a high-end cocktail bar like this. Seeing it here is like that feeling when you start to notice that lots of people are suddenly wearing Crocs or drinking coconut water or whatever. It's rarely an accident. Some company has invested major time and money in building that trend. You never see how this kind of thing starts, but right here, you're listening in.
Where Jägermeister really did very well.
It's hard to hear in a noisy bar, but this is where a corporate strategy is executed. The way it works is Jäger hires Böse and others to talk the drink up to a carefully selected group. They're trying to get influential bartenders and drinkers to embrace a story that's about flavor and craft, not shots and pukey frat guys. To understand why, we need to step out of the bar and into the drink's strange history. With a difficult name and an intensely bitter flavor, nobody saw potential for Jägermeister in the American market, except one who knew he had something after a single sip. Everybody he ever worked with knows the story of what he said.
It tastes like money. That was classic Sidney Frank.
Amanda Blanco is marketing VP at Sidney Frank Importing Company. In the 1980s, Frank took a drink for old German men and turned it into a young party drink, into the young party drink. He single-handedly created a category that the liquor industry now calls challenge shots.
It kind of came out of nowhere.
Donna Hood Krecha follows the drinks business for Technomic.
It was one of the first brands that was really built through really no marketing dollars in terms of advertising and commercials and things like that.
Frank hired attractive women, dressed them in skimpy Jaeger outfits, and sent them into bars to pass out shots. It doesn't sound very original now, precisely because the entire liquor industry copied the tactics he invented to make Jägermeister a hit. Ted Wright is CEO of Fizz, a word-of-mouth marketing company. He's a big admirer of what Sidney Frank pulled off with Jägermeister.
I think as far as beverage alcohol in the United States, I think it's probably one of the top five achievements in the last 50 years.
Frank actually has two of those. He also created Grey Goose Vodka basically out of thin air, later selling it to Bacardi for $2 billion. Frank was a colorful and generous billionaire. When he died in 2006 at age 86, obituary writers had a field day, highlighting the $24 million bonus he gave his secretary and his extensive collection of homes and private chefs. When he got too old to play golf, he hired professionals to play private matches for him. Since Frank's passing, Jägermeister has had a tough time in America. The drink has been declining for years, falling another 7% in 2014, according to Technomic. Understanding why is obvious if you visit a certain type of bar and know what to look for. We're now at a Philadelphia establishment called Simply Irish Pub, On weekends, it draws a young and rowdy crowd. I stopped in on a weeknight to meet up with Americus Reed, who's not a regular. He's a Wharton professor specializing in how brands connect with consumers. We talked with bar manager Sean Stenstrom.
When I first started about 3.5 years ago, we used to sell a lot of Jägermeister. After that, the Fireball craze kicked in.
As Jäger's volume faded, Fireball Cinnamon Whiskey doubled to a whopping 3 million cases, taking the lead in the category Jäger invented. That's why the company thinks its old story of shots and parties isn't enough anymore. It's now trying to reach more refined drinkers by playing up its European heritage, complex ingredients, and barrel aging. It's a tale that happens to be true, but it's jarring because it's a very different image than the company has been touting. I asked Reed if he could think of a company that's intentionally telling stories so vastly different to separate audiences.
Those examples are extremely hard to come by, if not impossible, because the hallmark of marketing and branding, if you think, what is branding? Branding is telling a consistent message that resonates to a particular group of consumers that you've defined as your target you're trying to go after. And so no marketer I'm aware of attempts to try to have two different messages to two different groups because it's just too dangerous.
So it's in risky, uncharted territory, breaking cherished rules of marketing. On our way to another bar, the Irish pub manager had something for us.
What do we got here?
This is a chilled Jägermeister shot.
He drops the glasses in front of me and Reed.
I don't want to date you, but roughly how long would you say it's been since you've done a Jägermeister shot?
Ooh, it's probably been about 20 to 23 years.
Okay, cheers, sir.
Cheers. Wow. Yeah, I'm starting to feel confident.
That reaction shows just how powerful Jäger's invented story as a party drink is. It drowns out the true story of its history. The company concedes the challenge of selling Jäger to cocktail nerds and the risk of alienating shot drinkers, but it's pushing forward, another risky bet from a company famous for revolutionizing marketing. Some people think it can pull it off.
People that are influencers in booze that they've never thought about Jägermeister in this way before, that's going to be interesting. And then when they go to a party and they're using Jägermeister like that, or they're out and they're like, yeah, make me a Negroni with Jägermeister, everybody at the table is going to go, what? That's crazy. And then they get to tell the story.
That's Ted Wright again. He used influencers to spread a brand story when Pabst Blue Ribbon hired him a few years back. The beer went from business disaster to hipster icon in a short time. Wright thinks Jäger's heritage story could be a winner if it gets to the right people.
Influencers are 10% of the population, but drive 90% of all of the sales. I would be psyched about this because you could go do this and you can open up a whole new world.
Americus Reed and I step into the Franklin Bar to meet a real-life influencer, one Jägermeister is courting hard. It's a trend-setting cocktail bar run by Sarah Justice.
Pretty much exclusively focused on cocktails. That's what we've always done.
Jägermeister reps have hit her up multiple times, and they failed. It's not in any of Franklin's signature drinks. She won't even carry it.
What if someone's sitting at our bar and sees it and they're like, oh, let me just do shots of that. And it's like, oh, that's not really what we do here.
That kind of strong feeling underscores Reed's point about just how hard it is to sell to two crowds at once. We wrapped up our market research with a couple of non-Jäger cocktails. Donna Hood Krecka, the liquor analyst we heard from earlier, is skeptical too. But she's also riveted by what Jäger's attempting.
It's part of the fabric of the alcohol industry. In a sense, you're rooting for it because it was such a colossal, colossal brand at its height.
Which brings us back to the New York bar where we started, listening in as the Jägermeister troops try to claw that ground back. In fact, the Up and Up's menu now has a cocktail with Jägermeister in it. And it's pretty good. Niels Boza, Jäger's profane and poetic ambassador, ponders the victory as he takes a sip.
It's like an invitation to gaining the trust of a more serious drinker. This kind of drink is an outstretched hand.
Whether enough people take it will determine whether Jägermeister's risky bet will end in the kind of surprise win that made it famous. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech, in real life.
From formatting to sponsors, this Super Bowl's arguably the techiest in history. And so we're going to talk about that with Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Lizzie.
All right, let's talk about streaming, because watching this game is different from, you know, all years before.
Yeah, it is a little bit. For people like me who don't have cable, don't want cable, and whose live sports fandom is, shall we say, not exactly diehard, this is a light at the end of the tunnel this year. CBS is broadcasting the game, but also streaming it for free in a number of different ways. The CBS Sports app can be found on Apple TV, Xbox One, Roku, an iPad, Android, and Windows 10 tablets. You can also point your computer to CBSSports.com. If you're streaming on your phone, Verizon Wireless customers can do it through the NFL mobile app. Remember, stream while connected to Wi-Fi, Lizzie, not over a mobile network to protect yourself from those data charges. And interestingly, the ad experience is often different online. All of the national TV ads have been put into the live stream as well, though some of the local or regional ad experiences might differ a little bit. CBS is doing this for free, which is interesting and new. And why? Well, they'll probably get a ton of data by doing this, and that data is valuable.
Yeah, that's the big question for me. What do they get from this data?
Well, they'll be tight-lipped about exactly what they are getting, but what they'll use it for is a deeper understanding of exactly who is live streaming versus watching it on cable and just how much. And they'll use that to inform their programming for streaming content going forward.
So I can imagine a Super Bowl 5 years from now, you, Ben, get a targeted ad that's totally different from the ad that I, Lizzie, get, because they know who we are.
Totally. You might get an ad for the Hot Wings restaurant in your neighborhood, and I might get an ad for the pizza restaurant in my neighborhood. It might work like that. Yeah.
Okay, so that all actually makes a lot of sense when you think about money and the money behind sports and tech. So what else is happening?
So CBS is stepping up its camera game for the big game this year, Lizzie.
Yeah, that's a terrible pun, but go ahead.
iVision 360 is the name of a system of 36 cameras the network has placed around the stadium's top deck. The purpose is to let us see something we haven't seen before, a kind of Matrix-style view of the stadium. You remember that movie, those 360 views?
Yeah.
Also, a first-person shot of the quarterback's point of view. That's never been done before. You can imagine that some of this stuff might be used in future big games for a kind of virtual reality football experience, which would be kind of amazing.
Yeah.
There are also a bunch of cameras capturing extra sound.
Well, why, for what?
Part of this is to allow referees to have the most clear and thorough replay footage to base calls on.
Oh, okay. The stakes are pretty high for that. So this is all about delivering the game. But for the people who are there interacting with tech at the game, what's different?
Well, this is the Super Bowl being held in the Bay Area, Lizzie.
Right, Tech Central.
So there has to be Wi-Fi access, of course. There are a reported 13,000 Wi-Fi access points underneath the stadium. Users can join those networks for free. And since there are so many of them, that will hopefully prevent clogging.
So we're inundated with Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Yes, but there's one thing to think about here. Online security.
Okay.
Joining a public network is something you want to do pretty carefully, Lizzie. More chances for getting hacked abound in situations like this.
So how are they being careful about that?
Well, the NFL is coordinating with the Department of Homeland Security. We don't have specifics on security measures, but that's not unusual. Whenever you're in a public place like this, it's always good to remember to be careful about inputting passwords and usernames. It's just like the airport or the coffee shop. Don't do your banking while you're at the big game. Don't log in to a service without being sure your connection is secure. Unlikely that it will be. Basically, use your info as little as possible.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide through the somewhat insecure world, I guess, of tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Want to catch up on past episodes of the show? Just visit MarketplaceWeekend.org to peruse the archive. Earlier in the show, you heard about the low price of oil and what it's doing to Gillette, Wyoming. Low oil is hitting big companies, too. BP just reported huge losses, the worst in 20 years. The falling price of oil has hit producers like BP, cost thousands of jobs, and made headlines like the ones we played for you earlier. But it's worth remembering that we've been here before. Here's a story by Mickey Clark from our partners at the BBC. We're going to take you back in time, starting musically. Hit it, Peter Gabriel.
Well, it's enough to make J.R. Ewing weep.
The price of oil throughout the world is plummeting. North Sea oil fell today to its lowest level for more than 6 years.
Oil has become the most volatile commodity of 1986. The price touched rock bottom on Easter Monday, dipping beneath $10 a barrel.
When you think of the 1980s, you think of a different era. Shoulder pads, power dressing, giant mobile phones. Have things really changed that much? Those reports could have emanated from earlier this year. In 1986, the oil price collapsed almost 70% from the year before. A drop in demand and overproduction were to blame. The once thriving North Sea oil industry was hit hard.
Dormant oil rigs around the coast of Scotland are the outward and visible sign of the slump in oil production. There are 20 idle rigs today, and hardly a day passes without another gloomy prediction about job losses. 3,000 have already gone, according to one estimate. BritOil are expected to announce 800 redundancies later this week, and a further 11,000 jobs could go in the next 3 years.
As the price dropped, the Texan oil barons suffered.
This depression has hit the southern states faster than any they've known before. The smaller oil millionaires have gone out of business and stopped drilling altogether. One of them, Clayton Williams, used to say he was in oil. And now?
What I'm really in, and I'm in it pretty deep, and that's debt. I have been known as an optimist, but this is the most frightening time that I've seen in my 29 years in the oil business.
And that's what's frightening investors and producers today. China is no longer consuming oil at the pace it was, and the booming shale means that the US is less reliant on imports. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is refusing to reduce output. So the unanswered question is, just how long will the recovery in the oil price take? Will it be quick, or will it take 20 years like it did last time? Colin Smith is Director of Oil and Gas Research at stockbroker Panmure Gordon.
I think in terms of price recovery to anything like $100 a barrel, that is, if ever, a very long way into the future, because one of the other key parallels with the situation that we've got at the moment is that technology in the form of US shale has once again proved able to commercialise a lot of hydrocarbon that was otherwise uncommercial, and that genie is not going back in the bottle.
One thing for sure, oil is becoming increasingly more expensive to get out of the ground, but the producers must continue to invest in the future. Not much chance of that if they start racking up losses.
That was the BBC's Mickey Clark. And that's our show for this week. Let's keep this conversation going. With President Obama unveiling his budget proposal this week, we want to know, what are your priorities in your own budget, and how do you plan to get there? Let us know by visiting Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Haley Hirschman, and with help this week from Shayna Deloria. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.